fun. Never thought I'd come undone. Could it be I'm the one you want? Pleased to meet you. Take my hand. Got forever. Understand. Every day I make new plans. And it feels like love. And it feels like, yeah, it feels like love.
Good afternoon and welcome to Vertical Live Radio. And this portion is A Taste of Ink. And I'm your host, Celeste Duckworth. So today, we're excited to welcome our featured guest, Mark Wallace McGuire. Mark Wallace McGuire is an award-winning author, columnist, and publisher whose works have appeared in dozens of publications. He is the author of the fictional series, The Alexandria Rising Chronicles, for which he was named an Independent Author of the Year finalist and a Georgia Author of the Year nominee. He is also the author of the nonfiction works, Confessions of a Special Needs Dad, Odyssey and Hope for the Journey, and Letters from Red Clay County. And we are just honored to welcome Mark today on our program. We're going to be talking about his books, especially the Alexandria Chronicles, which I've been reading, and I've actually added all of them to my reading list for the summer. It's quite an engaging book. So just to give you a little bit of information, or I'll just say a synopsis of the first book, The Alexandria Chronicles. So I'm just going to give you a little bit of a synopsis, and then we're going to welcome Mark onto our program. So Rand O'Neill, an ambitionless newspaper reporter, is given a single task upon the death of his grandfather: to destroy a mysterious map. What should be a simple errand thrusts Rand into a journey across three countries where he discovers humanity's biggest secret. Everybody, thank you for your support today, and let's welcome Mark McGuire. Good morning, good afternoon, Mark. How are you?
Good. I'm very good. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. I am doing fine, and actually, I'm excited to have you on the program as well. I've been reading the book. I've actually been getting caught up in the book, so I was like, okay, well, you know, I'm definitely going to have to read the whole chronicle for this. Very, very well written. So welcome to A Taste of Ink Live. I'm excited to share your story with our audience. So my first question is, give us a little bit of information about where you grew up and about your family life.
Great. Well, thanks again for having me today. I'm honored. I grew up all around the South. My father was a preacher, and we moved every 2 to 3 years, and I lived in roughly 9 or 10 cities by the time I graduated from high school, in the Carolinas, Georgia, Alabama, and Kentucky.
Okay.
And there's a mile deep of beautiful and
state to state or wherever they send you to pastor. What was the probably the most interesting place that you lived?
I would say probably the most interesting place was a small town in western North Carolina called Far City. And what made it so interesting was at that time of my life, it was second through fourth grade, but there was still a childlike wonderment I had about me then.
Mm-hmm.
And being in western North Carolina, we got a decent amount of snow. You had the foothills, and I suppose I sound a little elvish, but I still think there's magic in the mountains.
Okay.
So, I mean, I own it, you know. But growing up in that area with that landscape, where you just had the beauty of the foothills and the woods, and it was a small town, so kind of that Mayberry feel to it. The church my father pastored in was a beautiful church, physically, architecturally. And I think a lot of that just kind of came together. It was before the, quote, loss of innocence. There was still wonder in the world, and it was a beautiful area. And it was just kind of set it up as my ideal. And, you know, it, the older I get, sometimes you wonder, well, was it just because of who I was then? Is it really that great? What if I went back now? But at the same time, that really doesn't matter because that is what it is, if that makes sense.
Yeah,
so,
tell me about home life. What was home life like for you?
It was interesting. My father worked a lot. He was very devoted to the ministry, and I mean that in the purest way. I told someone, if Dad was working late, he wasn't at the country club making friends, but he was at the hospital visiting the sick or visiting the shut-ins or volunteering. He had a real passion for ministry and for civil rights work, and so he was absent a lot, and I spent a lot of time with books were my best friend, my first best friend, just because when you're moving all the time, you don't have an anchor, and those were my first anchors, and then later, basketball was another anchor. I would have liked a more stable life, but I'm not whining or anything. But I mean, all in all, I grew up, you know, in middle class, you know, Southern America, and I don't have a lot to complain about.
Well, I totally get the moving around a lot. We moved around a lot as well. So it's, you know, there's some things when you get older that you feel like maybe you missed, like maybe, you know, you having those. I used to envy people that had like child friendships from, you know, maybe school and stuff. And I used to envy that. But then it's kind of like, you know, it's kind of a trade-off when you're talking about the wonderment and the adventure of, you know, being in different places and being able to explore. And that's what I got out of our family, you know, traveling a lot. And I'll say that I have friends in different places now, maybe not the childhood friends, but, you know, there's something to be said about all that traveling as well. You know, very positive.
You know, I went through many years, honestly, probably 20, 25 years of really struggling with not having a hometown. Because you know, it's all about the person. I've met other folks like this, and they say, I've got friends everywhere, and I learned so much. And I dealt with a lot of resentment and a lot of sadness because I wanted that hometown. I wanted that place that I could say, hey, that's home.
Right.
But I flushed a lot of that out of my system with one book I wrote, which hasn't been published and I don't plan to, but there's always a struggle there. But I've made peace with it. But and you do get older and you know, you wonder, again, kind of going back to what I was saying, that wonderment, would it have been perfect?
ability.
Right. And then at this point, I'm thinking, well, now I've got a 12 and 11 year old, and I don't know if it would have made any difference to them or not. So, strange truths along the way. And I'm talking to my son, do you want to stay here forever? No, Dad, we can move to North Carolina. Really? Because I would have just been really upset. I mean, it's like no matter which way you go, it's kind of a catch-22.
That's true. That's true. I know as a parent, I traveled a lot. I think my kids didn't have that some stability, and what's really cool is they still have friends from, high school or junior high, but we did travel a lot. And they were able to maintain those friendships, but they got a lot out of the traveling too. I made everything was a lesson, a history lesson when I traveled.
Right.
So it's kind of interesting now. They've taken the best of, I think, what they felt they had in their childhood, and they've just made it what it is. So I think for us children that didn't have a stable home in the place you call your hometown, I'm like you. You make peace with it. And then you just kind of be like, these are my favorite places, What
right.
I love about these different places, So, yeah, I totally can rate that. So what inspired you, besides the reading, what really inspired you to start writing?
I started writing at a very young age, like most writers. But my story's a little different. I never wanted to be a novelist. I never wanted to write a book. I went through the whole high school and college, and I had poetry published and did yearbook and so forth, but I was more concerned about being a scholar or a musician. As I jokingly tell people, I failed at everything until I feel like God finally said, okay, now have you had enough fun trying all these fun things? How about you do what I put you there for?
Yeah.
So,
right.
Fell into journalism 20 years ago and have been doing that. And then on the creative side, just to jump ahead because those journalism stories aren't that exciting, I mean, really, I could put you to sleep talking about those, but I wrote my first novel, and I'm kind of jumping around here. I guess it was about 8 years ago, and it was about my childhood.
Okay.
And it was very good. It saved me a lot in therapy. And But when I finished it, when I read it, it just made me sad. So my philosophy was, if I'm going to write a book, I want to write the book that I want to read. I want to write a book that's fun, that's fast-paced, that has suspense, and world creation, and imagination, and broken heroes, and twists and turns. So that all gave birth to the Alexandria Rising Chronicles.
Okay, great.
Yeah, it was, for years my wife would say, honey, I want you to write your novel. And people would say, when are you going to write the great American novel? And I'd say, I'm not. Or I'd say, when I'm ready. And granted, it waited till I was ready, which was, shortly after 40.
Wow. And, and that's actually, tell you honestly, the writers I've interviewed, there's been very few that I've interviewed that I could say that were under the age of 40. It's been very few. And it's really interesting, even though we see some that are, younger than 40, but I think that great novel or that best book comes out, I think, that after you're seasoned a little bit. You really have to be seasoned somewhat when you're starting to write that real good novel, And I'll say about the, I started reading the first book of the Alexandria Chronicles, and one of the things that was very interesting for me was that you have a real knack for, I hate to say it's just detail, but it's kind of like, you have a real knack of really blending in all the details, so you're not, it's not like just reading the book and you're like, oh, here's this here, oh, this here, it's actually the way a person really lives, and that's the part that to be exciting and adventurous and thrilling at the same time?
Yes, yes. People joke about writers drinking while they write novels. You know, everybody talks about Faulkner or Hemingway or whatnot.
Right.
But this writing novels is my favorite drug. And it's, I don't need anything but coffee. And it's, to me, it was very, I don't want to use the word therapeutic. It was beyond therapeutic. It was fun. I told someone, I can't go out and run from people and get in a fight and find a secret world when I'm commuting to work. But my character can. And this was, I wanted to write into, some people chase the market. And if that works for them, that's fine. But I figured if I was going to put all the time it takes in to write a novel, I was going to do it my way. And I don't mean that stubbornly, but you know, as much time as it takes to write a book, if you don't enjoy what you're doing, then don't do it at all.
Well, that's true, and I like what you said about. Well, I like what you said about some people chase the market, because I think that. I think sometimes when a person chases the market, you get lost. You get lost with maybe your original thought, I feel, okay? At some point, you start chasing the market. Or when I see writers that they'll have a great first and second book, and they're chasing the market, or the market's chasing them, and the third book is like, okay, what happened? You know, it's just, you know, right. So I think that, I like the way you said it. I think you should write what you want to read. You know, what's exciting to you. And I think there's an audience for that, you know.
Definitely, definitely. And that, it's been very liberating when I decided to take that step. And there is a bit of a creative fear when you say, you know, I'm going to write this book, and it's not as deep as Pat Conroy, or it doesn't have the symbolism of Faulkner, or it doesn't have the great prose of Alice Walker. But I'm going to write this book because this is what I enjoy. And there's a little bit of fear there, and there's a little bit of ego. But again, at the end of the day, if you're going to spend that much time writing it, forget the inner critics or the outer critics. Just go with it and have fun. And the best compliments I receive, people say, I can tell you really enjoyed this. You really enjoyed writing this? And I go, oh, God, yes, I do. Or I did, and I do. Right. So it's... you know, kind of go bold and go forth and do it and have some fun.
Well, I really enjoyed the prologue to the Alexandria Chronicles, to Alexandria Rising. I enjoyed it because usually I don't enjoy prologues too much. Sometimes they don't make the connection, okay? I really enjoyed this prologue, and I want to ask you, what gave you the idea to start in the 1600s of London, which we know is a pretty bleak time in Europe. I mean, when you really think about it, what prompted you to start it or do the prologue in that particular time period?
You know, actually, after I finished the book, I wrote the prologue, I had tied in Shakespeare, and I won't give away any spoilers, but he crops back up later
exactly.
in the book. Okay, and I thought, I've always loved a good prologue. And kind of like you, if it's a 30-page prologue, spare me.
Yeah.
I don't want to read it. But if it's something that sets it up, I love
go into the story itself. And you're right about that time period. I mean, I love history. And so it's always interesting when I'm reading books, you know, what the writer's writing. Sometimes I'm like, yeah, you know, they're writing, especially romance novels, you know, and you're reading through them, and it's kind of like, yeah, this really wasn't like that back in the day.
Right.
You know, and it really wasn't all that candy-coated back in that time, so it was really pretty interesting. I said it kind of drew me in just reading that first part and then reading the rest of it. I was like, oh, okay, you really captured that time. So that's why I thought that was an interesting story. So how did the characters for the book come to you, or did you, you know, I know some writers will, you know, they'll, which is hard for me to do, they'll say, these are my characters, and they'll say, and these are their habits and their looks. How did your characters come to you?
That's a great question. When I start a book, I have a rough idea of my main, you know, two or three characters. But then...
Okay.
Frederick Buechner once wrote, he said, sometimes you'll have a character and the character will take on a life of their own.
Right.
And I've had that where I'll have a minor character and then they're a major character.
Uh-huh.
Or I'll have a character and A, B, C, and D are their main characteristics, but then, ooh, let's look at E. How does that work?
Right.
So, it kind of depends on the plot. I don't sit down and sketch out. I do a rough outline, but I don't sketch out every detail of the novel.
Right, okay.
And that gives some fluidity to the creative process. And I know some people, that would drive them crazy, but that's how I work. And
I think it's interesting that you don't really sketch out. I think it's interesting to learn the character as you go. That's just my preference. I think sometimes when it's totally sketched out at the beginning, it takes away some of the mysterious, you know. And I don't know if this has happened to you, but have you ever been writing a character and you all of a sudden you say, well, you know, this character needs to be a little bit meaner right here. I mean, I think it kind of gives you a little bit of an opening because, you know, we know sometimes the story writes itself. Sometimes the story says, yeah, no, I don't want them to be this. I want them to be this. So, you know, I would just say it's more interesting when you don't draw out everything about the person. Now, when I was, you know, reading your thing and reading about Rand and you know, and there's a few little things that comes out about Rand, and I'm like, oh, okay, well, right? So I'm glad, you know, it just makes it more interesting, I think.
Oh, that's great. No, that's... My two favorite ways to develop characters are through dialogue and action. And that's something I really strive for instead of saying, Rand is 6'3", you know, he's blah, blah, blah. He's, you know, telling the reader. I like to kind of show that through his dialogue that he's a bit of a, you know, smart aleck or wit. Or that when he, through things he does or things he says throughout the course of the book, and then you kind of get to build the character around them, like you said, instead of it all being served up on a platter. Here's Rand.
Right.
He's 6'3". He was once athletic and now has a beer tummy. He likes to make the jokes. And think, wow, you're a beautiful lady, and 10 years ago I would have been handsome. So that's fun. I'll tell you, just a quick aside, though, the neatest thing with characters is I'll get dialogue in my head. And I'll dictate it onto my phone, and then that will actually later go into the character development.
Okay.
And it'll just be a line in my head where the main villain in Alexandria Rising, he has some just wonderful condescending lines. And he's so nasty. And I got a lot of those before I even described him physically. I had already written those lines down.
Right.
And that's just kind of neat.
So when did you know that this was going to be a chronicle and not just one book?
I'll tell you. I left the door open at the end of the first book, and I said, if it's successful, I'll write a second one. And but then, honestly, I was like, meh, whatever.
that was maybe, well, how much of that was really driven by, you know, when I was reading the reviews for all the books, but reading the reviews for Alexandria Rising, you know, how much of that, I mean, because you have a lot of people just love that book, okay? You have some great, all your reviews are really great. How much of that was also fans wanting to see a sequel?
Yes, that really was the big impetus. I mean, honestly, I had people emailing me I've never met and from different parts, you know, of the nation, a couple overseas. What's next? You left us on a cliffhanger. What's next? What's happening? What are you doing? And that was a huge encouragement. And I've tried through my social media and so forth to really thank the fans because, you know, as a creator, we often work in a vacuum. And I just didn't know. I was like, I think it's a pretty good book. I put my name on it. I wouldn't put my name on something I didn't believe in. But those encouragements, even on, you know, the most self-doubtful of days after the first book, I thought, even if only a handful of people want a sequel, well, I mean, why not? What else am I going to do? I mean, that's kind of, I have a weird perspective. And, you know, it turned out to be more than just a handful of people, but... And actually, I have enough for, like, three prequels and all this other stuff. I don't know if I'll ever get around to it, but when people were willing to take the journey with me and were excited, I'll tell you that, I mean, that does something for your confidence and your drive. And even today, just hearing you talk about how much you love the prologue, I'm thinking, I'm going to have to tell my wife I'm taking the rest of the weekend off and huddling in the study. Celeste wants more of this. I mean, it's... when people encourage you, it's just a huge tonic.
Okay. Well, I know that, you know, I know that just reading this one, reading this first one here, you know, I'm looking forward to reading the other one. So tell me, what was your biggest challenge in writing the book? Because I know that, and we all have different challenges. What was your biggest challenge, and what was maybe... the thing that kept you encouraged to keep on writing it and finding the time to write?
I think the biggest challenge is always time.
Okay.
And in editing and rewriting, writing a book, it's not easy, but writing a book is when it's the rewriting and the proofing and the editing that drive us all crazy. And yet that's the most important part.
Okay.
As far as time, I don't watch very much TV, if any.
Okay.
And I don't have a lot of other outlets. So when I was writing this book, I was commuting 10 to 15 hours a week. I was working 40 to 50 hours a week, trying to be a good dad, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
But every second I could find, 20 minutes at lunch, I'd be in the park with my laptop. Or 10 minutes... here, there, and I write in the margins of life. I tell, I just write whenever I can. So time was a challenge, but I just ate it up when I got involved in it. And I said, I can actually finish this book, and this is actually fun. And then I started drawing symbols and getting in a little crazy, and this is too much fun not to do.
Right.
I think part of it is, I was just going to say, I don't have a lot of other outlets. And again, that it just is what it is. You are who you are, so.
Right. Well, you know, it's really interesting because really when you're a writer, it's, you know, you're almost so into it and you just love it. Like, you love it. You're just, you don't really need any other outlets except to tell yourself, okay, well, you know what, I really should go out today, or I really should, you know, go see something else, you know, today. But, you know, for the most part, when I'm talking to other writers, one thing that we all seem to be the same at is that you really don't have a lot of outlets. I think even your outlets become a vehicle in some way to go towards your writing, you know.
Exactly.
So when you're saying you're out, so you know, I have that great little tool of Evernote on my phone. So it's like, now that it's on there, it's like, oh, you know what? I'm out here enjoying this thing. Oh, this would be a good book. In fact, I said that to my daughter. It was kind of funny, but, you know, I'm always teasing her about the squirrels outside the house. And she always talks real mean to the squirrels. And I said to her, I said, you know, the squirrels are actually taking note of you every day. There's a squirrel sentinel out here. And I said, you know, there's going to be a thing. I said, that'd be a good book called Squirrel Squadron.
She goes,
Mom, you're so crazy. I'm like, no, I'm just a writer, and that's just the stuff that we do.
That's right.
So, you know, you just have all these little weird outlets, you know, that, you know, I think we take them for granted that, you know, it seems weird to us, but it's, you know, really, really not as weird as we think it is. How would you feel about your book as a movie?
I would love that. I've had so many reviewers say this really needs to be a movie. And I know every writer wants that, but I write kind of very visual. I mean, I try to use the other senses as well. But I would love it. I think it's made for a movie. I had a Lithuanian book reviewer who said, this needs to be a movie. Please make it a movie. And I'm thinking, well, I'd love to, but I'm not going to make a movie. But I think it's made for a movie. It's made for Netflix. It's got the kind of classic James Bond, Jason Bourne, Dan Brown type of twists and turns. I'm a huge fan of Lost. And I think that some of the broken characters in Alexandria Rising, I don't want to say owe it to Lost, but I was inspired by it. If you ever saw the show, just the fact that, hey, you can have a hero who's a, quote, sinner.
For sure.
And I'd love to have that in the movie. That's definitely on the list. I was at Pinewood Studios last week for something completely different. But I dropped off two copies of my book to a couple of producers over there, and they said, I don't know if we'll have time to read out the book. I said, hey, it's okay. Just leave it here on the coffee table. Maybe it will magically float over to Marvel or whatnot, but
You never know, Mark. I mean, we're speaking it out here in the airwaves, so you never know.
See, exactly. I had the same conversation with my wife earlier today, probably 2 or 3 hours ago, just talking about how things link together and you meet people and one opens another door. So, and I'm big into that. Nothing ventured, nothing gained, as, you know, William Shakespeare said.
So,
that's
true.
Definitely.
A movie's
on the list.
Right. So, now, how did you get your title for this book? Did your title come first, or did your title come, you know, did you just have the inspiration to write the book, and then the title came? How did you get the title Alexandria Rising?
That's a great question. I think the title came somewhere near the beginning. As I mentioned, the dialogue lines or the plot lines that would pop in my head, I'd write down. And one of the key ones was when the villain Kent St. James says, all was not lost when the library at Alexandria was burned. And that was my great, huge, this is going to blow your mind away statement. So, with this whole idea, the idea was the Library of Alexandria, that knowledge rising, it's coming back. And I love the title. Some folks, you know, I didn't want to call it Rando Neil Goes on an Adventure or anything else. And it fell in, and then when you read the rest of the books, Reborn and Redeemed, it really falls into this huge story arc that goes all the way back to the library at Alexandria, and it gets more into that through the story. So,
what I love about history, I think, and even when you were talking about traveling, I think the southern states and the east coast, there's so many mysteries in that, but I think that when you're also looking at reading certain things in history, there's a lot of mystery in history that just, I think it's just a wealth of information or a wealth of ideals for a writer.
Yes. Yes. There's so much, so much out there. And if there were rolled enough in time, I think I could write 2 or 3 books a year just based on a history. You know, the ship, the Mary Celeste, whatever happened to those passengers, or who really were this group that did that, or what was going on in northeastern Russia in 1000 BC.
Right.
Wow. I would love to write a novel on that. I have no idea, but give me 3 weeks to research it, and I can come up with a character and some swords and mysteries, and it really is amazing how much this, you know, great history, like you said, is out there that no one has written fiction about. And I love
so how do you really do your well research done. when you're writing, how do you do your research? Do you do your research as it comes to you while you're writing, or do you say, you know what, I'm going to write a book about this and I'm going to do a little bit of research on this? How do you do your particular research, and what resources do you use?
Great question. I do my research as I'm writing, and I have, for the books, I had 2 weapons experts I interviewed, because I didn't want to say he pulled a gun out and shot at somebody. I wanted to say what type of gun it was, and then to say, if you shoot somebody from this range, what will happen? As far as on another book, I needed some work dealing with earthquakes and foundation repair, so I interviewed someone with a foundation repair company. Some of it I've been able to do through the internet, like how many miles a Learjet can get on a tank flying against the jet stream from Maine to St. Louis. And I mean, some of that you can just kind of figure it out. And then there's some scholarly articles as well in relation to Shakespeare and Mozart, where you can go through and read scholarly works. But it's...
Okay.
It's... I tell folks, you know, the research with these books has been very taxing, because if I'm asking you to take a step, to take that suspension of disbelief, I've got to make sure that everything else in the, quote, real world is perfect.
And
I can't say, Bill jumped in a plane and flew around. No, what kind of plane was it? Is this realistic? Because otherwise, Celeste could read it and go, you can't go in one tank from here to here. This guy doesn't know what he's talking about.
Right.
It's very important doing that.
Well, also, too, when you're, you know, I think that it's a great touch to add, in the sense of that detail being very, just being very concise to the point where when you're reading it, you're like, oh yeah, I get that. You know, I really get what he's saying there. So definitely I would say that, you know, that's probably the way that I think researchers should be done. But let me tell you this though, let me say this to you. How did you keep from being distracted, because I know, as a writer, when you're doing research, it's very easy sometimes, you're doing research and you're focused on one thing, and something pops up, it's like, oh man, that's actually very cool. How do you keep from being distracted and saying to yourself, well, this doesn't really belong in the book right now, or, you know, are you like other authors where you have mounds of papers and notes sticking out places where that could be eventually into another book?
Both of those. I have, first of all, my wife has been an amazing sounding board and editor through the entire project, and she's just always, honey, that's great, but does that really help the book? And I owe a lot to her. But then I also
is your book, Confessions of a Special Needs Dad. And I wanted to ask you about it because I know that, you'll see a lot of books of this type with mothers writing them, but it's not, I do know some men who have written books, but it's not many men that have written a book like this. So tell me why you felt you needed to write this book.
I wrote this book, and it's an edited compendium from my blog, specialneedsdadchronicles.com. But I wrote the book the same reason I started the blog, and it was because there was a vacuum. And when my son Andrew was born 11 years ago, and he has a chromosomal deletion and a handful of other things that, left him with special needs, there was nothing out there. I remember vividly going to Borders bookstore 11 years ago and going to the self-help and psychology aisles, and there was not a dad blame thing, to use a southern term.
Wow.
And it was sad because there's a great loneliness, there's great despair, the suicide rates and divorce rates for special needs fathers are through the roof.
Wow.
And I wanted to write something where other fathers, this was mainly for new fathers, to read and know, hey, you aren't alone. And then also, in the book, there's quite a bit of religion and philosophy, and not preachy, but to say, listen, you can be angry at God. David was angry at God. Job was angry at God. Christ was angry at God. And letting people know, and, members of their families and extended families too, but hey, it's okay. We don't have to put on a smiley face and say, praise God, everything's great. No, it's not great. You're hurting right now. And you're in a lot of pain, brother. And I wanted to, but this is a resource because I've had, through the blog, I've had special needs fathers from Tennessee and Pennsylvania reach out to me and thank me. And because there's nothing out there really. There's a few other books and some of them are very well done, but it was one of those, as I told someone, and I'm really big on the honesty part, was I think it's important sometimes. Andre Nouwen talked about what makes a great friend, and sometimes it's just somebody to hold your hand and listen.
Yes.
And when I wrote these books, I don't have all the answers. I don't have all the solutions, but this is to let you know you aren't alone.
Yes.
So, it's a bit raw at times, but I don't apologize for that. But I think it's important for especially dads, and especially their friends and families. When people say, I can't imagine what you're going through, and here, now you can know, because I'm not going to tell you, but this crazy son of a gun in Georgia tells everything.
I'm going to tell you, I read where you wrote, the first few months, too much confusion in me, too much rage, too much of a chance for the short fuse in me to be lit, and I didn't want that, and I was sure that they wouldn't want it either. And I do believe, like you said, I think a lot of times people don't really want the answer. They want to know how to deal with it, I was saying when I read that, I was like, I had to give you much credit for that because men don't really express how they feel about stuff in a way. Women kind of are a little bit easier to express. And women, I think women are also, because it's easier for us to express the emotions, it's also easier for us to accept, we accept and then we just say, okay, what are we going to do now? This is what we're going to do, and we just go for it. But I think men feel it really more than women do, in a sense, and they don't say much about it. So I had to really say to you, thank you and give you props for even putting up your blog and for writing the book, because it takes a lot of bravery for a man to do that.
Cool. Well, thank you very much, Celeste. I appreciate that. It's, I just,
know, we work near people. We live in a world that's really interesting. We, you know, we communicate through social media. We communicate through our phones and texts. And I say we sit right next to people at work, and we never ask people, how are they? You know, how are you? You know, so I do like the fact that you said, you know, yeah, sometimes you're, you know, sad, and sometimes you're, you're mad. I'm a believer. I get that. We're not happy, you know, I don't think it's that we're not happy. I just think that, you know, we're just human. You know, what I would ask you is that when you're in that point there, that at that place, what helps you bring the joy back into yourself, and know that, you know, you bring that joy back into your heart. You say, okay, you know, I don't get it all, but let's get out of this and just move forward. What makes you do that?
There's two or three things. First of all, I need to get out that rage and that sadness. And to me, that's either writing or exercise, and usually both. But
okay.
I've told my wife ad nauseum, I'm like, honey, I will deal with this, but I've got to go on a hike first, or I just need to walk around the block. But once I get that honesty out of me saying, I don't know what to blank and do. I don't know this. I don't know that. I'm so angry. Then I can kind of step back a minute, and I'll look at my son, my youngest, who has special needs, and he can be so sweet. I think about the verses from John and Matthew about what you've done for the least of these, you've done for me. I'll think about all the people, and this has been so important. Changed our families and my son's life, who had no reason to. And by that I mean the person at church who volunteers to spend Sunday mornings with Andrew so the rest of us can actually go to service.
Wow.
And I think about the people who do special needs baseball, the Challenger League, and some guy who doesn't know my son from anybody is coming out on a Saturday morning and volunteering to pitch to these kids. So with the help of another volunteer who doesn't know these kids, can learn how to hit the ball. And when you see that, and you say, you know what? Despite the headlines, despite my own anger, there is good in this world.
Right.
And Celeste, I'll tell you, the people I have met on this journey, they floor me. And I believe in saints because I've met them. And it's also, as I told my oldest son, and I've always said, hey, listen, you know, you never judge anybody by their paycheck or their title or anything like that. You know, your character and etc. But then, and I was raised that way, and I've always believed that way. But then when you get to this even more, and like I said, the people who don't even know Andrew, or they don't know me, and I'm thinking, I wouldn't have done this on a Saturday morning. I would be sleeping in. Why would you do this? Because there is a goodness in the universe, and you have embraced it, and you're showing it. And when I think about that, that helps me refocus and go, all is not lost. Things can be done. Things can get better. Things will get better. And maybe not outside exactly of me, but inside of me too.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't mean to give you a whole sermon there, but you can tell this is very near and dear to my heart.
In fact, you know, I would love to, you know, we have our magazine, Vertical Life Magazine, and this is something that I would love to share. On our magazine, maybe we can share some of your blogs on our magazine. It's something that I think, you know, I'm learning, and it's something that I know. I mean, I know there's people out there that don't, they probably don't contact you, or, you know, they're probably not going to contact you on your social media or whatnot, but there's a lot of people out there that's probably going through stuff. And I used to be very hesitant about, you know, posting a lot of things on my social media pimp, but then I would be out about town, and people would see me out town, and they would be like, "Oh, you know, Perez." You know, I'm like, "Yeah, hi, how are you?" And I would meet them, and they were like, "You know, I read your thing on your Facebook, and it's just very inspiring." And it's like, "Okay, wow." You know, I mean, it's pretty cool when people tell you, but you know, you and I know that's probably a bunch of people that will never say to you that, you know, "I read what you write," or "Thank you for writing it." But, you know, I think somewhere in me it says that when you have a gift to touch people, that you have to put it out there, you know, because there's some person that's actually, you know, reading what you say. There's some person that's inspired by what you say. When you're talking about the suicide rate, how high it is, that's something I would never have thought about. You know, in the grand scheme of things, I mean, we know other things, but this is an area that, you know, we probably don't hear a lot about. So for me, you know, when I was reading through it, and when I went to your blog, I was thinking, you know, we could share this in our magazine. This is actually something that's about living. It's about living a positive life, and it's about, you know, hey, it's not perfect, but we can make it perfect, or we can make it positive, you know, within our own selves. So, no, I appreciate you sharing it with us.
Well, I appreciate you giving me the opportunity, and I love Vertical Life. I'd be honored to anything I could share. But one thing I mentioned at the beginning of the book, and I said this is for special needs dads, it's for special needs families, mm-hmm. but this is also for anybody who's gone through something. And I wrote that because I do think there's some themes in the post where I'm writing this from my world, but, you know, like you were talking about earlier, truth-telling. How are you today?
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, right. I believe it's in King Lear, the paraphrase is, "Too many times we don't speak the truth, but we say the things we ought to say," which is, how are you?
Right.
I'm fine.
Right.
So I think there's some, I mean, there's things that, whether you're dealing with a family's illness or a personal illness or a job issue or a spiritual issue, some things, they transcend, whether it's a special needs father or whatnot. And I think those are the types of works, and I'm talking, you know, outside of myself, but just in general, the great writers that...
Right.
That touch everybody. I mean, Maya Angelou said, "My friends, we are more alike than we're unalike."
That's
and I remember
true.
Reading that.
That's very true.
It is. And it's, I read that in 1994, and it stuck with me since. Because at the end of the day, when everybody thinks what they want to think, and whatever, political, social, artistic, at the end of the day, we all want to be loved. We all want to be accepted.
Right. That's true.
So.
Okay. Well, I want to talk a little bit more about, you know, what you do. You have a business, MWM, and
yes, ma'am.
Tell me a little bit about that, and tell me what you do at MWM.
Yes, MWM Communications. We are a full-service creative agency.
Okay.
We serve every client. Everything from creating logos to writing press releases to photography to launching publicity campaigns. We cover it all. I've had clients in the construction industry, the retail industry, general circulation, and in the last year,
my feelings. I know that I know a lot of people are driven to go to bigger companies, but I tend to feel that smaller businesses, and it's not smaller businesses, don't get me wrong, audience, doesn't necessarily mean that it's just a one or two people, but I tend to think smaller businesses have a better advantage at paying attention to the details of their clients. Sometimes I think they put out something that's really very unique to the client. So as being in the communications and media for you, do you find that there's still people that are very ignorant about the social media marketing aspect of their business?
Yes, extremely. And it's the whole thing with it, and shameless plug here, I have a Mark Wallace and Wire author page on Facebook. All y'all follow me, like me, share me, yada yada. But, I had to do that slip. So...
That's okay. Hey,
yeah.
That's what you're here for.
That joke, right? But I had to do it at some point. In all seriousness, I tell folks, I said, you've got to engage. And
right. Part
of the social media with businesses especially, you've got to engage. And by engaging, it means you need to be accessible. If you're let's just say a widget company, people don't want to read posts every day on widgets. They want to read, here's a way your widget can save you money, or our headquarters is in beautiful Bakersfield, California. Here's a beautiful sunrise shot of where I work, or here's our homeless dog. But it's creating that sense of interconnectivity with clients and potential customers, and not just saying, here's our product, buy it. Here's our product, buy it.
Mm-hmm.
And I've fought a few clients on it. I've had some who bought in, and it's worked. But social media, a lot of people are still figuring it out. But I always preach, it's really just talking to people like they're people.
That's,
and
you know what, that's very true. That's very true.
And every post doesn't have to be a home run, and every post doesn't have to be about you. Add a friend. Just a quick aside, he runs a landscaping company. And I was talking to him, and I said, you love Tennessee football. He said, yeah, I'm a big Vols fan. I said, how does the grass look today on the field? He said, it looks beautiful. I said, there's a post. Look at the beautiful field today we're going to play on in 1 hour.
Right.
So, it's keeping it accessible and real and not just pushing a product down people's throats.
Okay. So let me ask you, do you have any current projects that you're getting ready to launch or that you're working on?
Yes, I do. And I'm excited because I'm almost finished with the third round of proofing of my next novel. It's called In Pursuit of the Pale Prince. Yes, I'm going even crazier. it's a young adult novella, and it's in the fantasy genre, and I wrote it in first person, which I hadn't done before. And I coined a lot of words.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I've told someone half jokingly, quick aside, I said, I think I did so much research with the Alexandria Rising Chronicles that by the end of it, I just wanted to write a world where I could create my own laws.
said, you know, this man created all his languages and all the characters, and you know, my dad was a Star Trek fan. And I was like, you know, when I look back on my teacher telling me that and look back on all those old episodes, and I'm like, dang, this man had all of this in his head, you know?
Exactly.
And he created this huge cult following. And then when you think of everything that spun off from that, so I'm glad you're excited. I can't wait to see the release of that, you know. Especially reading Alexander Rising, and everybody out there, when I complete the Chronicles out, you know, I'll be putting more shout outs out about it. One other question I have, you're talking about I always ask writers when I come to, you know, the end of a program, I always ask them to give us advice to up and coming writers. And I do that because I think there's something that all of us have learned that to be, you know, it's very different from the norm of what writers will say, you know, this happened to me, and I always ask writers this question: what is your advice to up and coming writers? Because I always learn something new from people, which is really interesting. I think one of the most interesting things I heard recently was a person said there is no such thing as writer's block, and I was like, oh, and they're like, when you have writer's block, go find something else to write.
Find me there, and the website for the books is www.alexander.
part of our new edition. And Mark, I just really appreciate you coming on today. Great conversation. I can't wait to have you on again to talk about more of what you're doing. And we'll definitely be sharing this. And I'm going to enjoy loving the fact that we can share your blog as well. I'm always looking for more stories and writings and blogs from men. Men and fathers are a very important part of, I believe, of life. And I think that we would love to have blogs from you in Vertical Life magazine. So I'm looking forward to sharing those as well. So Mark, thank you for being on the program today. We really, really appreciate you.
Celeste, thank you so much for having me today. I've been honored, and I really appreciate your time and interest. And keep up the great work with Vertical Life. I really do appreciate it.
Thank you so much. And everybody, thank you for being supportive for Vertical Life magazine and Vertical Life Radio. We really appreciate you. It's been a great day, really, and we've enjoyed our interview today with Mark Wallace McGuire, and I hope you do look him up. And hey, have a great day today, okay? And I want to thank also my team, Team Vertical. Thank you for volunteering and planning and production of A Taste of Ink Live, and you can follow us on Blog Talk Radio. You can follow us on iTunes, and you can follow us on Mixcloud. And we'll be looking forward to see you next weekend, everyone. Have a great day. This is Celeste Duckworth.
Feels like